and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extent to which scandal dominates politics today and how every political incident nowadays ends up with a gate attached to it, the latest of which is the recent so-called Secret Service scandal, which is yet to be branded Secret Service Gate. But stay tuned. Matt Bai, the national political columnist at Yahoo News and a former chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, joins us to discuss his new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid, which traces the current fusion of news and infotainment to the scandal that erupted around Senator Gary Hart back in 1987, when he was the frontrunner to be the next president of the United States, way ahead of George H.W. Bush in the polls, only to become the laughingstock of late-night television and a footnote in history. We will examine what happened to break the tradition of silence about the private lives of politicians, in particular presidents like FDR, JFK, and Lyndon Johnson, who the press knew were engaged in extramarital affairs, but never went public with the information. Then we'll hear from John Dean in an interview I did with him back on August the 7th, when his new book came out, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. We discuss the mother of all political scandals, Watergate, and its legacy on journalism and in politics, as the reforms that took place in the wake of Watergate are being rolled back, and all political scandals since, whether large or small, have been given the Gate label, whether they deserve it or not. And joining us now is Matt Bai, who's an author, journalist, screenwriter, and Yankee fan. He's also one of the nation's leading voices on American politics, best known for his stories that explore change in society, generational, technological, economic, and how that change is breaking down old institutions and transforming the politics of a new century. Matt is the national political columnist at Yahoo News, and before that was chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, where he covered three presidential elections, and he also was a columnist for both the magazine and the Times. He's the author of the new book just out, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Bai.
Oh, thanks, Ian. I'm thrilled to be here.
And here we're in Washington now. We have almost everything that happens is called a scandal, or it's given the acronym of a gate. Now, I guess the latest one is a scandal over the Secret Service. But you're really talking about when scandal went mainstream, right? When politics and scandal fused, and I guess since then we've been afflicted by this new hybrid.
Well, you know, you're right about Washington. I sometimes wonder if anybody out there under the age of 40 knows why we put gate on the end of all these stories, or whether they just think it's an opening to something. I don't know. But the moment I revisited in 1987, I think, is quite critical, not because it invents a political scandal. There are a lot of scandals, some of them personal and some having to do with corruption. I mean, this comes, of course, 13 years after Richard Nixon resigned from Watergate. But because I think it marks a sea change in the prime directive of political journalism. And I think before 1987 and the events surrounding Gary Hart and his presidential campaign, political journalism was primarily focused with the explanation of agendas and worldviews and ideas, and trying to understand the visions of men or women who were running for office. And I think after that period, by the time I got into political journalism, and much of the book, you know, some of the book is quite memoirish, the prime focus becomes, you know, we know you're lying, we have to figure out what the lie is and take you down. And to the point where we've gone so far past reasonable accountability and so much closer to a kind of search and destroy mission that politicians really don't think they can discuss any idea with any kind of nuance, and a lot of people don't want to take part in the process.
But given that Watergate was the mother of all scandals, did that, to some extent, change the rules? Because it wasn't so much that Richard Nixon had romantic dalliances. In fact, I've talked to top of a number of people that were close to him inside the White House, and they kind of wished he would have, because he was such an uptight guy, you know. But he did, I think. I recall that the thing that took the scales off the eyes of the American people was when the tapes came out, was the tone of the chief executive swearing like a trooper. And that seemed to sort of disillusion a lot of people. So to what extent did Watergate lay the groundwork later for this important stage in American political life with Gary Hart?
Well, I think you put your finger on something very, very important, critical, because Watergate is a political scandal. It's not a personal scandal or a sexual scandal, as we know. But what it does is it really injects a new focus on personal morality, on the character of a politician. This concept of character had been around for a while, even when Nixon becomes president. But it really comes into sharper focus then. And as much as we talk about how journalism saved the day and how Woodward and Bernstein were sort of the heroes of the Watergate moment, the other side of that coin is that it was terribly embarrassing for political media, because here you had a Washington press corps that had known Nixon in public life for decades, since he was vice president in the 1950s, and yet somehow had never brought to light the fact that his actual stability, right, his paranoia, his not just his worldview, but his emotional makeup was really not what you'd expect in a chief executive. And I think the journalists who start then to come into the picture after Woodward and Bernstein, who are inspired by that example, who are drawn to journalism by Watergate, they really take a very different view. And you see that view in the Hart scandal in 87, which is the first time that personal behavior becomes, for a presidential candidate, a disqualifying issue, and the first time that surveillance and this kind of investigation is done into a private life. You hear these journalists talk about their rationale and say, you know, we're not going to decide anymore what the public should or shouldn't know about a candidate. We're not going to get caught the way the journalists got caught in Watergate. We're going to give you every shred of evidence. We're going to give you every lie, every hypocrisy, every flaw, and you get to decide as a voter whether you think it matters or not. And that was very much the mindset that had taken hold in the media when that scandal erupts in 1987.
And of course, before this all came to pass, there was JFK in the White House, where there was a stream of women, it seems, cycling through, not to mention that there were two secretaries on the National Security Council, codenamed Fiddle and Faddle, who would often swim with him in the White House pool. So that was all known. Johnson running around in the middle of the night in the Senate with his pants down. All of those stories were circulating amongst the press corps. And I'm sure you've seen this new series by Ken Burns on PBS, Matt Bye, on the Roosevelts, where it was so clear that there was an arrangement with the press corps, particularly with FDR. They didn't cover the fact that he was so crippled by at least they went along with the idea that he wasn't so crippled by polio. And so talk us through how the rules were before the rules were broken with Gary Hart.
Well, I mean, you outline it pretty well. I mean, generally, the press would cover personal behaviors and sex lives if they burst into political view, if they became relevant. So the case of, say, Nelson Rockefeller, who, as a presidential hopeful in the 1960s, divorces his wife, marries a much younger staffer with small children. I mean, this became a problem for him politically in the Republican world, and the press had to cover it. Chappaquiddick, of course, another example, criminal matters, Wilbur Mills. But there's a couple of differences. One is they don't go looking for the evidence. In other words, they don't pry into personal lives looking to prove that you're not keeping your marital vows if it's not a political issue. And it's not an all-defining or disqualifying issue. In other words, scandal is not, it does not define your entire character or fitness to serve. Nelson Rockefeller, for all of that, excuse me, ends up vice president of the United States. So it's not as if he was drummed from public life. That all changes in the Hart moment. And, you know, Ian, what brought me back to this story, because it is not... it's not really a meditation for me on privacy and the boundaries and the rules, because it wasn't all good, you know, before. I mean, you could argue there was a lot about John Kennedy we should know. It's not all bad after. So I'm not making this is not a manifesto. What brought me to do the book is because this story of Hart is so amazing and compelling and forgotten and misremembered when it is remembered. But it's just, you know, the notion of this guy, how it was kind of the Hillary Clinton of his day in terms of where he was in the Democratic Party going toward that election, cornered literally against a brick wall in the oil-stained alley behind his house by four reporters, you know, peppering him with questions about his marital life, who, you know, within the week would be sitting in front of a national audience in New Hampshire, asked the question that no presidential candidate had ever expected to hear: have you ever committed adultery, Senator? You know, this story, which we haven't thought about in a long time, even when you go back and revisit it, and this is what really got stuck in my head and led me to write the book, it's just an amazing human story, and the human toll, the story of how he carries that guilt and ruin through the years and tries to get back into public life and is so stigmatized. I think it's just all very compelling and very illuminating about our moment.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Baer, who's an author, journalist, screenwriter, and Yankee fan. He's also one of the nation's leading voices on American politics, best known for stories that explore change in society, generational, technological, economic, and how that change is breaking down old institutions and transforming the politics of a new century. Matt is the national political columnist at Yahoo News, and before that was chief political correspondent for The New York Times Magazine, where he covered three presidential elections, and he was also a columnist for both the magazine and The Times. He's the author of the new book just out, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. And in terms of the week that the politics went tabloid in 1987 with Gary Hart, the conventional belief has always been that to some extent Gary Hart brought this on himself by challenging the press to follow him. I believe it was a paper from Miami where he said basically, you know, I'm living a dull life and there's nothing going on. And clearly the reporters knew that there was more than that going on. And by giving them an invitation to follow him, he therefore became fair game.
Yeah, this is really misremembered, and this to me is really the most shocking part of this story in terms of what we remember versus what really happened. That is the popular perception, but the truth of the matter is that Hart did say that, and he did say it before the scandal, but he said it to a single reporter, E.J. Dionne, who was writing for the New York Times Magazine. And the quote had not yet appeared or gone public or been out at all to anyone at the time that the Miami Herald gets the tip that Hart is having an affair and decides they're going to stake out his townhouse, surround it, and find proof of his infidelity. It's only during the stakeout, after they've started, that they get an advance copy of the New York Times Magazine and they see this quote. And what they do is they take the quote and they reference it in their story, which comes out the same day, about the affair, so that in the public mind, the two things get very jumbled together. And then when anybody says to them, well, you know, didn't you change a lot of rules here? They're able to say, well, look at Hart. He challenged the press. He said, follow us around. And the significance of this is follow me around. And the significance of this is really vital because you know, in the months and years after, what everyone knows, they think, what everyone decides and remembers, is that Hart issued a challenge, which, by the way, it really wasn't. It was more of a sarcastic throwaway comment out of frustration, and that's how it was perceived at the time, even by the reporter. But putting that aside, the perception is that Hart challenged the media to follow him around, and then they did, and stupidly he got caught. And as a result, he changed the boundaries between public and private lives. He invited us into his bedroom, and by doing so, he invited us into everybody's bedroom. And really, it's his fault, and he's been sort of stigmatized with this, that, you know, Hart is the guy who changed the rules. That's just not true. The fact of the matter is that decision was made by reporters and editors at the Miami Herald and supported and subsequently made by a lot of other reporters in the media. And by the way, I respect a lot of those reporters, and I respect Tom Fiedler and the others at the Herald very much, even if I question the decisions that were made. And we never really had a conversation about why those decisions were made and whether they were the right ones, because the cause and effect was in effect reversed in the public mind.
But presumably the conversation did go on at the Miami Herald. And so what gave them permission to change the rules? They had to know that this was a presidential hopeful, and more than that, even a likely presidential candidate, Gary Hart. The field was pretty open then. He was way ahead in the polls, ahead of George H.W. Bush, who really wasn't that strong a candidate. So what kind of discussions went on? Were they aware, the Miami Herald, of that they were crossing the Rubicon?
Well, you know, they were aware that they were doing something that hadn't been done before. But it's interesting, the Herald, a week after the stakeout and the subsequent scandal, after Hart has left the race, because all of this unfolds in 5 days, which is really, you know, at the heart of the book, the Herald publishes a reconstruction, a long account, about a 7,500-word account, which is, you know, huge by newspaper standards, and quite remarkable because it captures the moment in a lot of detail. And nowhere in that piece, not once, do they talk about any discussion of whether this was or was not a story they should do, whether they should or should not put Hart under surveillance. And when you talk to them now, there's a lot of, you know, I talked to Tom Fiedler, who's the main reporter at the Herald who gets the tip, and his character in the book, and you get a lot of different, there are several rationales that Tom would go into, but really the focus was on hypocrisy and character. And I think, you know, as we talked about earlier, I think there was a real hangover here from Nixon and Watergate, and the feeling among a lot of younger reporters particularly that you could not allow another liar to get into the White House, that a lie was a lie was a lie, that all lies were equal, and that personal morality was now a critical factor. And Hart had gotten up before the country when he announced his presidential campaign a few weeks before this, and he had said, I'm going to hold myself to a higher moral standard, and I think we all should. And he was talking about Iran-Contra, and he was talking about the Reagan administration and a series of scandals that had rocked the second term of Reagan's administration. But these reporters, when they're in the alleyway accusing Hart and trying to get answers from him, they bring this up. They say, you know, Fiedler himself says to Hart in that alley, you know, you said you'd hold yourself to a higher moral standard. And I think, so their rationale, you know, I think that was always their rationale, was that you can't be a moral person and be unfaithful to your wife. And I think we have to think hard about that, because moral people do immoral things, and we are not, as Bob Carey said to me once, and I write about it in the book, we are not the worst things we've ever done in our lives. And there's a tendency to think we are, is what he said. And I think we in political journalism got into a mindset after 1987 in particular that we can reduce and should reduce politicians to the worst thing they've ever done, because only then can we protect the public from the depths to which, you know, to which they might sink. And I think that's created a distortion of, you know, pretty complex human personalities, because we're all complex.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Bai, the author of the new book just out, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment, returning with Matt Bai in a conversation about his new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm continuing the conversation with Matt Bai, the author, journalist, screenwriter, and the author of the new book just out, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Matt, you mentioned earlier that the Miami Herald was acting on a tip to look into what Gary Hart was up to when he was very much the Democratic frontrunner for president running against a very vulnerable George H.W. Bush in 1987. There's such a thing in Washington, it has this wonderful euphemism called opposition research, where the Democrats dig up dirt on the Republicans and vice versa, and they have full-time operatives doing that. Did this tip come from opposition research?
Well, that's a really interesting question, Ian. The tip itself about Hart and Donna Rice, the woman with whom he was, you know, caught essentially in Washington, does not come from opposition research. It actually comes from a friend of Donna Rice's who was a model in the Miami area like her and was a little jealous and was tired of hearing her go on about how she liked this senator and was hoping to see him in Washington and bought a ticket. And she and another friend of theirs basically dime him out and try to sell the photographs they have from her camera. So it's one of these great, you know, moments, and I'm sure there are many, many in history where, you know, somebody acting out of a pretty petty human emotion can sort of change the course of history pretty easily. But it is interesting that you saw the beginning of something in the political culture here, because in the weeks before that happened, there had been a bunch of people from other campaigns fanning the flames and saying to reporters, you know, you should look into Hart's personal life. You all should be asking questions. And at one point, Hart, after his announcement, gets very frustrated hearing this and says, you know, it says something to the reporters on the plane to the effect of, you know, you shouldn't take this from other campaigns. I know other campaigns are saying this and it's a distraction and you shouldn't be asking questions about it. And the media, of course, takes that, the reporters take that as, oh, now it's fair game. He's criticized other campaigns. Now it's a political issue, right? And so they write even more stories about it. And it's a cycle that we would, you know, I bring it up because it's a cycle we would see repeated for decades afterward, and it happens all the time now, but it was new then, where you're asked about your personal behavior. If you refuse to answer, you're hiding something. But any answer you give, whether it's another campaign is trying to smear me or you know, follow me around, whatever answer you give actually creates more stories because you're now defending yourself and you're on the defensive. So he found himself in a box, and his aides found themselves in a box in 1987 that would later spawn an entire industry of experts and consultants who could figure out how to navigate it and would charge a lot of money to do so. But at the time, it was all new, and part of what I think is interesting in the book and interesting about the story is how shell-shocked they were and how much they were groping their way through something that no presidential campaign had ever experienced.
Well, when you talk about how the girlfriends were the Achilles heel and tipped off the press about Gary Hart being involved with their friend Donna Rice, who they were a little jealous of, I'm a little bit reminded of the great scandal in the Clinton administration with Monica Lewinsky, the extent to which she was befriended by Linda Tripp, who clearly had a political agenda. And one of the most amazing ironies about American politics is that when a president comes into the White House, the building is absolutely empty. There's nobody in there. And when Nixon came in, the building was completely empty, and he had a rule that nobody from the Johnson administration would be in his White House. And one person slipped through the net, and his name was Alexander Butterfield. He had worked in the Johnson White House as an Air Force aide for the CINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific, but he was a close friend of Haldeman's and therefore went through the screening process without Nixon noticing that he'd been in the White House prior. And so flash forward to when Clinton comes into the White House, the building is completely empty except for one person who was left over from the George H.W. Bush administration, and that was Linda Tripp, in all of all places, the White House counsel's office. Go figure.
That is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. So tell me about the connections there with, I mean, do you see that kind of irony that it's always the last loose end that people think of, or girl talk that does them in?
Yeah, I mean, to me, what's just so fascinating is the way you can never really predict. These things are always more mundane at heart than we think they are. I mean, for years there have been conspiracy theories about did Hart get set up, and Bush had been a former director of the CIA, and there was all kinds of mob and intelligence connections in Miami, and somebody who had, you know, been tied to the owner of the boat that they were on, the yacht that they first met on, had been shot dead and in an execution. And there's been all this sort of stuff floating around among some of the Hart loyalists. But the truth of the matter is, we now know, and I didn't know going in, that it was just this, a pretty ordinary woman who was living in Miami. And she, when I first started reporting this, I'd never heard of her, and neither had most anyone else. And, Donna Rice had always had suspicions about her, and I found her, and I called her up, and she, within 7 seconds, she said to me, "Oh, yeah, that was me, and I can't believe my secret lasted all these years." And she told me the story, and she was still angry at Donna Rice, and she was still angry at Gary Hart. And she said, she talked about Hart. She said, "You moron, you think you can run the country, and you're out running around like this?" And she said he had hit on her, but she had rejected him, and so she'd ended up with her friend. And it was just the kind of story you would hear in any gossipy place, 1,000 times. It's just that this one time, somebody who decided to do something about it actually had a profound impact, not just on 1988 and presidential politics, but on politics going forward and on the culture of the political media and on, the years that reverberated afterward. And I think a lot of history actually gets made that way.
For the longest time, though, in politics, my understanding, Matt, is that there's been this old adage that you should never get caught in bed with a live boy or a dead girl. So what happened to that advice?
Well, I don't know that advice dates back to Hart. I tend to think of that as more recent. But the thing you have to remember about Hart that I think is really, part of what I found going into the research for the book that I found really interesting is, here's a guy who, although he was identified very closely with the 60s generation and had been at the forefront of that generation, he'd managed George McGovern's campaign when he was 30. But here's a guy who was born in the post-Depression years in Kansas, born in 1936, into a very reticent culture where there's still tremendous boundaries of privacy in people from the West and know what I'm talking about. This sort of stoicism, and you didn't share your emotions, and you didn't share the details of private lives, and you didn't ask people for the details of their private lives. And then he comes to Washington much later, and he separates a couple of times from his wife. They had marital problems, and he admits he's public about the separation, but doesn't have any questions to answer about it. Dates women publicly in Washington during these years. I mean, this is not a secret thing. Takes them all over the place. He's, at one point, when he's separated from his wife, he stays on Bob Woodward's couch. He crashes there for weeks, and nobody ever asks him. Nobody ever says, "We're going to write about this," or "We're going to do a story about it." He serves on the Church Commission, too, before that, which is, he knows all about John Kennedy's activities because all of that surfaced at the time. So everything in Hart's experience, everything, led him to believe that these kinds of issues were not of interest to the media. He had good friends who were reporters. He'd known them for years and years, and they knew all about his personal life, and they never wrote about it. So when his younger aides started to tell him, "Look, things are changing, this new generation of reporters, they're going to write about this stuff. They're going to go looking for it." He couldn't believe it. He could be persuaded that it might become an issue for him, and he was angry about it, but he could not believe for a second that anybody was going to go rooting around into the details of his private life. And he believed very strongly that it wasn't anybody's business and he shouldn't have to answer questions about it, and that he should be able to retain some zone of privacy. And I think that cultural divide, to me is really fascinating, that it was Hart, but it would have been someone who got caught up. There was a lot happening in the culture at that time that was leading us to this place. And, it was him partly because he was this figure who had developed all of his attitudes and all of his worldviews in an era that was now passing him by.
And how does this coincide with the move from news to infotainment, given the demise of what they call the dead tree business, the newspaper business, the tabloidization of television, the full, mm-hmm. the 24-hour cable cycle? This all seemed to coincide and be a part of the mix, catching this politician, this rising rock star politician who had this kind of religious background. I believe even his parents were ministers, and I think he went to a seminary as well. So it's, the irony is, just, let's face it, for tabloids, pretty delicious.
Yeah, he went to a Bible college, actually, and to divinity school at Yale for a while. Yeah, you're absolutely right, and this is a big part of it, because there's a lot, as I say, going on in the culture at that moment in the mid-1980s, and I think this is something I think we've misremembered. We think of Hart as being the guy dumb enough to get caught. The truth is that he happened to rise and have his political moment at this moment where there were all of these forces coming together, and one of them is certainly about media and technology. Neil Postman, the tremendous social critic, writes his book Amusing Ourselves to Death in 1985, 2 years before the scandal, incredibly prescient, in which he argues that television has created an entertainment culture that bleeds through every aspect of the society, including politics and including news, and that we now expect everything to be a story that rivets us with characters and soap opera turns, and that it was dumbing down our public discourse. And, you know, Hart's run in 1988 would have been comes amid the first campaign where all the television stations now have flyaway satellite dishes and they can go anywhere remotely. And it's the beginning of television punditry. The McLaughlin Group is new. Crossfire has just launched a couple of years earlier. So there is this this sudden emphasis on entertaining, on keeping people in their seats. You can now go live from anywhere, any story, and you want it to feel immediate, and you want it to feel breathless. And it begins very clearly and very concretely to change the definition of news. I mean, in that year before the Hart scandal, right then, in the months before, you have the scandal with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, the accused preacher and his wife with the mascara-stained face. She goes on Nightline with him, and it's like the most watched interview Ted Koppel's ever done. And then they have the whole controversy about Fawn Hall, the secretary to Oliver North, who smuggles papers out in her skirt, and this becomes a big media sensation, more so than the details of the scandal itself. So there are a lot of omens here pointing to a media that's become, you know, very entertainment focused, and that has a lot to do with how quickly Hart unravels and how fast that scandal mushrooms into really a national joke, to the point where Johnny Carson's joking about it every night on the most watched, you know, nightly program in America.
And the Gary Hart story, I remember interviewing at the time when he was running at a round table with some reporters here in Los Angeles. And it did look like he'd had a rough night. And there was one cute journalist there sitting at the table who certainly looked like they were very close friends. But he, I've talked to him over the years since then. He's a broken man as a result of this. I mean, talk about, I guess it's maybe his religious background, that he's still sort of flagellating himself, isn't he?
Well, I think it's easy to understand. Hart was, first I think it's fair to point out that he was a really visionary politician of his time, and I think people forget that. He was really the first of his generation to hit the pinnacle of presidential politics, and he, or at least of the generation that really became activated in activist in the 60s. And he, he talked about the transformation from manufacturing to a digital economy. He talked about stateless terrorism and oil and the violence that it could lead to in the Middle East. He talked a lot about the post-Cold War era, reforming the military. He was really, out in front of just about everyone else.
Sure, he was the first to talk. He was the first to talk about Homeland Security.
Yes, and much later chaired the commission. This is one real reentry back into public life, was to chair the commission that effectively predicted the terrorist attacks in 2001. When he's drummed out of politics, we lose a lot. I mean, I think his service denied the country for all that time was unfortunate for the country. But, for him it was deeply painful because that's all he really ever wanted to do. And he kept trying to serve again, but he was so, being the first in this kind of thing, he was so stigmatized. And, he could have gone out and rehabilitated his image, given tearful interviews, written a memoir, but he fundamentally believed that was wrong and that it was nobody's business and that he shouldn't legitimize that kind of media. And he was really too proud to do that, which I think is a form of character myself. And so, he really spent a long time in exile. There's no other way to put it. And you know, yes, I think he feels terribly guilty. And this is a big part of the book. I mean, this is my favorite chapter of the book, is really all the years after for him in this cabin in Colorado and what he goes through to try and find some peace and to try and reinsert himself in public life. And I think he feels terribly guilty because he knows he put himself in a compromising situation and that a lot of people were counting on him and that events in the country might have been very different had he been elected. But I also think he feels, you know, just tremendously frustrated that he wasn't able to realize his own potential and that he wasn't able to serve, which is really all he ever wanted to do.
Well, Matt Beyer, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, and I'm really grateful.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Beyer, who's an author, journalist, screenwriter, and Yankee fan. He's one of the nation's leading voices on American politics, best known for stories that explore change in society, generational, technological, and economic, and how that change is breaking down old institutions and transforming the politics of the new century. Matt is the national political columnist at Yahoo News, and before that was chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, where he covered three presidential elections, and he was also a columnist for both the magazine and the Times. He's the author of the new book, just out, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with John Dean, discussing the mother of all political scandals, Watergate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation. In 2006, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program, and he is the New York Times bestselling author of Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, Worse Than Watergate, and his latest book, just out, is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It.
Which also has now made the list.
Oh, which list is that now?
The New York Times list.
Oh, excellent.
5 days out.
Well, congratulations. And, of course, August the 9th it will be the 40th anniversary of President Nixon's resignation. And clearly, you were, in terms of your testimony, it was all of the president's men against you, until our mutual friend Alexander Butterfield testified to reveal the tapes. And I guess you spent more time than any other human being on the face of the earth listening to these tapes. Would that be accurate?
Well, next to the staff of the National Archives, I'm right up there, I'm sure. And to my amazement, Ian, when I started on this book, where I really, my editor said, are there any questions you really think should be addressed before, as we approach this 40th anniversary? And I said, yeah, there's one. I've never been able to figure out how anybody as really politically savvy as Richard Nixon let a bungled burglary just destroy his presidency. I said, you know, yes, I was there, but I didn't deal with the president until 8 months after the arrest. So I suspect the answer's on the tapes. And the answer is on the tapes. But I didn't know that I would have to personally put together a team as well as myself to transcribe them all and catalog them all and digitize them all so that project could be done. And it took 4 years to do.
And you added 634 more tapes to the record.
Well, it's apparent to me that nobody outside the archives had even ever listened to those. And actually, it's much more than that. I did 1,000 tapes because I found the few transcripts that did exist, maybe 12 were really good from that had been used in the trial, that had been prepared by the prosecutor's office and the various defendants like Haldeman and Ehrlichman, who were on the tapes, corrected them. Those were the best that were existing. The rest were, from the prosecutor's office, were merely FBI secretary first drafts, and they didn't even know who was talking half the time. Stanley Cutler does a good job on the ones he did. He's a historian who forced Nixon to release a lot of his tapes. But Stanley's collection is pretty much, when I talked to him, I said, how did you select them? He said, the ones that looked like they'd be interesting. And I was trying to track it literally from the first day that Nixon returns to the office after the arrest on June 20th until the plug is pulled on the system to see what's revealed with every Watergate conversation. So I had to redo all of Stanley's because his are partial. An ellipses that he might put in the middle of a transcript could be 50 minutes of conversation I might think was important. Plus, I was able to digitize all this stuff, and that made me able to hear things people who worked with merely the analog originals couldn't.
And all of these tapes and all of this enormous effort that you've put into your new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, I mean, it's really the genesis and an analysis of the cover-up itself.
Because that's when the White House becomes involved. That's what Nixon becomes involved in. It also, however, is not solely isolated because one gets a pretty good feel for Nixon thinking about a lot of things. While they're not necessarily, I didn't seek those out. There are lots of other conversations that I didn't transcribe, but I'm following the Watergate thread through all this. Other things do slide in. And I didn't do it as a book of transcripts. It's narrative and dialogue. So I, in the narrative, often put in context what else might be happening.
But what's extraordinary about President Nixon is this total disconnect between the consummate foreign policy president and this foul-mouthed, deeply prejudiced, deeply flawed human being. It's extraordinary when you listen to the tape when he's talking about Daniel Ellsberg and railing against the Jews and a Jewish conspiracy and how they're all clever and deceitful and tricky and all of this stuff that almost goes back to the original Tsarist calumny about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I mean, it's amazingly reactionary stuff. And yet here's the president who literally saved Israel's bacon in the Yom Kippur War. So how do you...
He's a very complex figure. He's a fascinating figure. I was talking to some newsmen who are doing some material for the anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the resignation, and a couple of them said, we've studied lots of politicians, lots of presidents. Nobody fascinates quite like Richard Nixon. He's unpredictable. He is strong in some ways, but weak in others. And that makes him, he's totally unpredictable on these tapes. And the way I had them done, I had the transcribers working well in front of me so that I could do them in chronological order. I helped and transcribed about 250 conversations, but mine are very much at the end where the story was better known and what have you. So it's the beginning that I flushed fully out in the middle that nobody had paid any attention to. And it was just, to me, there's not a page of this book that something new doesn't pop up that I sure didn't know, including my own conversations, Ian, because I was able to hear the audio for the first time on many of them. And you get a whole different sense when you hear somebody, the inflections, the reactions, and all those things fit in, and the way I told the story, that I can put that kind of explanation in dialogue.
In terms of listening to yourself advising the president, the most famous phrase from you in this private conversation with President Nixon, which of course was taped, was when you literally tried to save him from himself, where you say there's a cancer on the presidency.
Tried to warn him. I didn't know time how much he knew. I do know today, Ian, because of the listening to all the conversations that preceded, as well as those that follow, that he knew much more than he was letting on to me. that he didn't know. He knew that hush money was being paid. He had personally been involved in raising hush money. He had sold an ambassadorship to get money for the Watergate defendants. He had suborned perjury of the key witnesses. He's deeply involved in the whole thing. But when I go in to warn him, I don't know that, and I'm trying to tell him that this is all obstruction of justice. And I get his attention by telling him there's a cancer on the presidency. As Stephen Colbert said the other night when I did his show, yeah, that'll get somebody's attention.
but it may have got his attention, but it didn't stop the trajectory, did it?
No, it didn't. I failed totally in my effort to try to convince him to stop it. Every time I raised a problem and a horrible, he had an answer. You know, I'd tell him, you know, people are committing perjury. Well, John, perjury's a tough rap to prove. You know, this will cost, who knows how much this will cost, Mr. President. Well, how much could it cost, John? Right out of thin air, I pull $1 million. That would today be what, maybe $5.5 million? Thinking that was a number that he would think just out of the range. And he said, well, that's no problem. I know where we can get $1 million. And I now know, and explain in the book, things like the fact that after I leave the office, he calls Rosemary Woods in and says, how much do we have in our slush fund, Rosemary? The one only that you and I know about, and they've got $400,000 in there. So lots of little facts and some big facts that we didn't know about Watergate emerged from the undertaking I took to listen to all the conversation.
And John Dean, Rosemary Woods, President's Secretary, of course, is famous for the 18.5-minute gap in the recordings where she had to do this extraordinary piece of gymnastics to demonstrate how she managed to erase this tape. That turns out to be not that significant, Ryan.
Well, it's not only not that significant, it was actually mechanically impossible for her to do what she thought she'd done. A friend of mine found one of the few engineers in the United States who worked on that machine, which was a Ur 500. They were imported from Germany. And he was actually queued up to testify and probably would have been brought back from the, I think he was in Portland at the time, to Washington, had the case not been dropped in the pursuit of the whole matter of the 18.5-minute gap. And he explains that every combination or permutation, if you will, of the way she explained how she believed she had erased it with her foot on the foot pedal and hitting the record button, or she thought maybe she'd left the button on and hit the foot pedal. Every one of those, the machine was built to not work in those circumstances. So she could not have done anything she said she did. The machine wouldn't operate that way. To make the machine erase, this guy says most women are not strong enough to even do it with one hand. They have to stand up and press with their thumbs. And they designed the machine to make it difficult to press the two buttons simultaneously. But a man can. And I put in, I do a whole appendix on this because, one, I think it's a non-issue when you understand what was erased. And all it's erased, really, because I know everything they said, because sooner or later it all comes out in one conversation or another, is the fact that he's aware of the cover-up. At a time he claims he is not aware of the cover-up. And that's what put the lie to his last defense, is that he claimed he knew nothing about the cover-up until I told him on March 21st. Well, the 18.5-minute gap occurs in June, almost 8 months earlier. So this is why it was erased. And either Nixon did it or the four other people who had access to the tape did it, either at his instruction or trying to prevent the problem that would confront him, because this was the only tape that was subpoenaed, and there are other conversations later on the afternoon of the 20th. This is the morning conversation that the 18.5-minute gap occurs. In the afternoon, there's a conversation about the cover-up. That evening there is one. There's one the next day, it's the next day, and then on Friday the 23rd is the so-called smoking gun tape that shows he was active in the cover-up when he has this, approves a plan to have the CIA block the FBI. So So there are many smoking guns, if you will.
But what's extraordinary, though, is that, and it really gives weight to this idea that the cover-up is worse than the crime, was that Nixon, according to the new research that you've done, John Dean, in your new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, is that Nixon did not know about the Watergate break-in to the Democratic National Committee offices. And that was organized by John Mitchell?
It was approved by John Mitchell,
right.
Yes. There's just not a scintilla of evidence that Nixon knew. So that his motive in the cover-up is he's protecting John Mitchell. Haldeman had told me on more than one occasion that Richard Nixon believed the only reason he was president was because of John Mitchell leaving his law practice and helping him get elected in '68. And he was just eternally grateful for that. So he felt very protective to Mitchell. He was convinced, as everybody else was, even before Mitchell admitted it, that Mitchell had approved these plans. It wasn't necessarily that he approved the break-in that day. What he did is he approves the plan in general. Liddy had already gone into the Democratic headquarters looking for information on Larry O'Brien, financial information. They hadn't even been able to find Larry O'Brien's office. So they went back in the second time to look for to go to the office, find the location of the office, put a bug in that worked, and actually their mission that night was to go to McGovern's headquarters. They're just going to stop by and correct this little problem with the deans at the Democratic National Committee. And had they been arrested, however, in McGovern's headquarters, as I point out, I found other recorded conversations that show that Nixon clearly gave an order to Haldeman to put a plant in McGovern's headquarters. I'm not talking about a flower. I'm talking about not that kind of plant, but that could be interpreted as anything from an electronic device to a secretary or an intern or a chauffeur or something like that. And had what happened is Haldeman then has his aide, Gordon Strawn, called Gordon Liddy to the White House and read him instructions, saying, change your intelligence gathering from Muskie, the front runner initially, and the likely candidate would run against Nixon, to McGovern, who had emerged as the person he would probably be running against. So had they been arrested at McGovern's headquarters, you'd trace it right back to the Oval Office.
But even what was done really was hadn't been done before in American politics. It's always been pretty dirty. A lot of money's changed hands, etc. But this was a whole new level of mendacity.
Nixon always felt that anything had been done against him was fair game, and anything any of his predecessors had ever done was permissible. The difference I found is that while those things had happened in the past, with Nixon they become standard operating procedure, whereas in the past they'd been the exception to the rule.
Well, what I find, though, extraordinary, and I think you can make the case that, and others have tried to make the case that our current cynicism about politics and politicians began with Watergate. And I recall when the tapes were first aired to the public, there was a tremendous shock in the public that somebody in this hallowed Oval Office could swear like a trooper and have such a foul mouth. I think it shocked a lot of people. But I think the most shocking thing that I find about our current era, our current political environment, compared to back in 1973 and 1974, is, for example, the Republican Howard Baker coined the phrase that you've kind of alluded to in your subtitle of your new book, John Dean, What Did He Know and When Did He Know It?
That's exactly what Baker ask me, if you will. I actually put the question in the front material. What did he know and when did he know it? He asked me. It's a very effective cross-examination technique.
Right, but the fact of the matter was he was a Republican and he was a reasonable man and he tried to do a conscientious job. You would not find anybody today, I don't think, in the Republican Party that would step up to the plate like Republicans did, because after all, it was phone calls from Republican senators and congressmen that finally convinced Nixon to resign, wasn't it?
Well, not yes and no. He was getting a lot of pressure. He realized he had no base left in the House or Senate. he could count noses as well as anybody else, and that he knew that the impeachment process was going to run its course, and he was going to be voted to be impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate. So rather than have that happen, he took his full resignation and his pension with it and left. So, this story that I recounted is just not a rehash of Watergate when I got into all this fresh material. It was more dramatic than I thought. It's much more human, the story, because the other material that most historians have relied on was just material that that prosecutors had pulled out to make their case and show the criminal activity. You miss all the context. You miss all of the agony and the effort, which, you know, when you cover it day to day, it's a very human story. There are lots of life lessons to read in something like this. I'm delighted that I'm getting reaction from reviewers that it reads like a novel and is very telling. One reporter who I talked to a couple of days ago on the radio said, "You know, John, I hadn't planned on reading your book. I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down." And authors love to hear that.
Well, you've got a Shakespearean character there.
Yes, you really do. He has remained fascinating. He is unpredictable in where he goes, and that makes the story go in all different directions. He has good moments. He can be very manipulative. He's a master at assembling. He can somehow keep his story straight to different members of the staff when he's giving them misinformation, as he's playing and manipulating his key aides, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Golson. It's quite fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, John Dean.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation. In 2006, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program, and he is the New York Times bestselling author of Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, Worse Than Watergate, and his latest book just out is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.